snowflakes beyond counting, return to one essence, an exquisite field of benevolence. Stepping into profusion, no one is forsaken, a boundless field of benefaction. So I received this card from Zen Mountain Monastery. I think it was a fundraising appeal. And it was exquisitely beautiful. And I wanted to share it with you. And that poem was on the left side of the card. And on the right side, there was a little message. And the message read, "Dear friends, in the midst of great change, the many differences can become deep divides. May we take refuge in the enlightened wisdom that peace resides within every moment and dedicate ourselves again to awakening that peace within every being." I don't know what doing the dedications is like for you, but for me, our dedications each time we chant is an interesting practice. So some evenings I might have someone in my heart in particular who is in some way facing difficult times in their lives, and that person will jump right to the forefront of my mind, and I'll just name this person who I care about and dedicate my sit to that person. Sometimes there's nobody like that in the forefront of my mind, and I might have to sort of search a little bit and think about the people in my life and beyond. Of course, everybody in some way in our lives, but people who I don't know personally, that where I know there is suffering in the world, and I might call up those places or people or creatures. And sometimes I recognize animosity in my own heart toward people. And it might be animosity over some political issue. Of course, politics is more than politics. It's policy. It affects lives. And I might find myself drawn into something where I think that undue harm is being caused, where we could align in a different way and do more good in the world. And I'll be angry, perhaps with policymakers or a politician, and will name that person or people in my mind and dedicate my practice to the very people who are making me angry and upset. And I notice how hard that can be to hold people in my heart with whom I'm troubled or angry. On very rare occasions, probably because it's a teaching in metta practice, a kind of loving kindness practice, I might even name myself in the dedications and sit for myself. That, by the way, is one of the hardest to do for me, and I think for many people. Anyone who's raised in this culture, it's kind of hard sometimes to send love to yourself. So just noticing all these different ways that the dedications arise for me, and how, depending on who arises in my awareness in a given moment, different feelings and resistances might arise as well. and to notice this kind of friction inside of myself as part of the dedication, as a mental formation, as a phenomena of the mind. Here I am dedicating my sit to someone, and I might feel animosity for the person to whom I'm making this dedication. Well, why make the dedication then? Because on some level, we all are suffering. Even the people who we may dislike or judge in some ways are suffering. And our practice is to save all beings and to hold all beings, allow all beings to reside in our hearts. This doesn't mean that we agree suddenly with what somebody is doing. We can still, of course, maintain our principles, but do I have to do it with hatred? So a part of my practice is to notice when this arises in me, this animosity, this part of me that thinks that I, of course, am right and someone else is wrong. It's, of course, I think it's fine to hold on to my principles or to believe certain things. But I do admit that I'm not always 100% sure that I'm right. I recently had a discussion with someone about climate change. And I found myself researching all the science again, because this person was saying that it's not really a big deal. Of course, this has been my my primary driving sort of social action these days, this concern that I have. So I was immediately like very upset, and I was like, well, I'm going to show this person up and look up all the science. And, you know, the science is pretty conclusive. And you look at all the data points and the arguments and interpretation. And the scientific consensus runs anywhere between, you know, estimates between, you know, 90 and 97% conclusive that this is really human caused and et cetera, et cetera. And in science, that's actually pretty good. That's pretty high conclusiveness. And the more one does climate science, the more likelihood that there's agreement. Agreement goes up to 97% among climatologists. And I thought, well, who are these 3%? I thought, you know, wow, there's actually 3% of climatologists are suggesting that maybe this isn't so. Now, believe me, I am not, 97% for me is good enough to act on. I would not want to play Russian roulette with a gun that was 97% going to fire on me. So this is in no way a dismissal of the conclusiveness of these findings. It is quite certain. And for the sake of all beings, certainly worth taking action, in my view, drastic action. And I do admit, 97% sure. There's something interesting that happens in that place where you acknowledge that there's this tiny bit of you that isn't 100% sure. It's very humbling, isn't it? Yeah, I guess it's possible that I'm wrong. Because you know what? I'm not God. That's a humbling thing for us sometimes to admit that. But it's a big part of our practice in the Zen tradition to be honest in that way. So this possibility, this little tiny bit of wiggle room, that I'm really not 100% certain about anything that I think. I mean, sometimes I feel that way. I have felt 100% certain before that I am the one who's right in my argument with Sandra. And I have turned out to be completely wrong. So whether I feel 100% right is not the best barometer of whether I am actually right. We read in this chant this evening, the heart of true and trusting. Only cease to cherish opinions. Do not remain in dualistic views and avoid dualistic pursuits. If there's a trace of this or that, of right and wrong, the mind will be lost in confusion. All dualities come from the one, but don't cling even to this one. When the one mind rests undisturbed, nothing in the world offends. And when no thing can give offense, things cease to exist in the old way. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the mind itself ceases to exist. When thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. When the mind subject vanishes, objects vanish. The mind is tricky. The mind fills, before we're even aware of it, with all kinds of language and beliefs about good, bad, right, wrong, this, that. So quick to arise. And these are all what we might describe. I prefer the language of calling these thoughts relative truths, because we need our thinking mind in order to function in the world. And it is true that if we eat one thing, we may be nourished, and if we eat another, we may die. And so it is important for us to acknowledge the relative truth. But it's also important for us to see in this practice that the relative truth is not all there is. First of all, it is often what I think is often wrong. Now, I may not see that at the time because I'm the one thinking it. I have a tendency to believe what I think. There's all kinds of studies out now about our own confirmation biases and our unwillingness to acknowledge information that contradicts what we already believe. So even though it is very important for us to rely on our thinking minds to survive in this world, to do good, to be engaged. At the same time, I think some amount of humility is appropriate, certainly in terms of how I, in terms of the content of my thoughts. I might make a judgment of a person, say of a student, for example. I might think this student is apathetic, this student doesn't care. This student is just a pain in my ass, in my classroom. And that angry fire might arise in me of judgment because the student has yet again done something disrespectful or hurtful to another student or what have you. And as it turns out, that student's mother has cancer. And the student's going through a terrible, terrible time and is trying so hard but feels like a failure. My judgments can be terribly wrong. And I think it's important for me to acknowledge that, to have some humility so that, and if I'm practicing, then when that moment, that flash of frustration and anger arises with that student, maybe I pause, just like we do on the cushion. I pause. And I say, I might not be right here. And keep paying attention. Maybe ask questions. A little bit of humility. What's interesting is I find that I'm in my judgments of people when that arises for me, I'm wrong more often than I'm right. I'm usually just trying to control someone. They've got pretty good reasons for behaving the way they are. So holding my own opinions a little bit more humbly. Now, let those fond opinions go, says the chant. How about hold them a little bit more humbly? Maybe don't cling quite so tight to them. Notice them as they arise. And stay curious. Keep looking. And the mind goes on and on, dividing into this and that. But there is a way that the world exists before this and that. A way that the world exists beneath the divisions that my mind makes. Somehow manifesting in its own suchness. Somehow beyond my capacity to know and label and characterize. Our language divides the world into this and that, and our conceptions mirror those divisions. But the world is not inherently divided. Now, of course, if we hold on to the idea that it is also oneness, that's another idea. And the moment we say one, of course, zero and two arise. So no need to hold on to oneness either as a concept of what reality is. No concept can contain it. And so we have metaphor, boundless field of white, where all the snowflakes come together. The undifferentiated realm. It's so healing to allow ourselves to sink into the thusness of the world, the sensations of our body, mind, this sensory world manifesting on its own. Nothing we need to do to create this. Simply the way things are. And it's healing because in some way it helps us see our divisions as just mental formations, as just kind of floating in the midst of a kind of unity that holds us at all times, in which we can have enormous faith. This language sounds dualistic. That there's the unity and then there's our way our mind divides. And this is how teachings go. Teachings do this. Here I am using language to try to talk about something that is not language. It's just our lives. And we can look at our lives from the perspective of conceptual maps and frameworks and what we call relative truth. And we can also just be aware. And our awareness includes these relative maps, but goes beyond these relative maps in some way. So it's not really dualistic, it's just what we already are. And this practice is about opening to that. And there's some way that it's restorative. And sometimes I think, you know, this notion, save all beings, is really a way of saying what the Buddha saw on the morning of his enlightenment. I, together with all beings, have attained the way. I, together with all beings, am enlightened, he said. It's already true. You are one of those beings, already enlightened by Buddha's enlightenment. Not separate. All beings already saved. To rest in this, to realize this, is healing, deeply, deeply healing, nourishing, something we hope all beings realize. In the midst of great change, the many differences can become deep divides. May we take refuge in the enlightened wisdom that peace resides within every moment and dedicate ourselves again to awakening that peace within every being.